WNTI 91.9 FM. It is public radio from the campus of Centenary College in Hackettstown, New Jersey. I'm Jack Devaney, and welcome to a edition of this class of bluesology that we have on Sundays that is welcoming a gentleman who is no stranger to the world of blues via the WNTI airwaves and shall be co-hosting and co-interviewing a very special guest we're going to introduce in just a moment. And the man I'm talking about is from the Just Jazz programming, Mr. Bob Bernotis. Bob, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jack. I'm really happy to be here with you, my old friend, Jack Devaney, and the gentleman whom we're about to introduce, my new best friend. I know him as John Sanders because he spent 5.5 years with the Duke Ellington Orchestra from February of 1954 to September of 1959. For the past 35 years, he's been known as first Father John Sanders, and now he is Monsignor John Sanders. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you, Jack.
It's good to have you here, Monsignor Sanders. And you know, we're going to get to hear about all the great music you've done with Duke Ellington and beyond. And of course, the special role that you've had as being a professional musician and now feeling your call in life as a father and as Bob shared, Monsignor. So I said to Bob when we said, we got to connect with Monsignor John Sanders. And I said to Bob, I said, listen, there's this guy, John Sanders. He goes, oh, you know, Monsignor John Sanders, you're from Duke? Yeah, I know him. I said, listen, let's go up and visit him in Connecticut, sit down and do an interview. And I could not come into the studio today because of my ignorance, but I'm going to learn a lot. And that's the whole part of the class of bluesology. And Bob, I'm so happy to have you here for this knowledge of jazz and beyond you'll bring to the table.
Well, thanks, Jack, but I think you know more than you admit.
So, Bob, please, we're gonna start almost from the beginning, I guess.
Well, that's where we want to start. Could you tell us about your first experiences with music, your background with this thing called jazz?
Oh, yes, Bob. Well, I grew up in Harlem in New York City, West 138th Street. We lived in an apartment building. We were on the first floor. And my family enjoyed music. They were mother and dad, my grandparents, my uncle Joe, my aunt. They were not musicians, but they loved the music of the times, the popular music, and they were always singing. And we listened to the radio endlessly, all the musical programs. My grandmother admired Bing Crosby. Mm-hmm. I listened to the recordings of big orchestras and singers on Martin Block's Make Believe Ballroom, which you could catch up with all the latest recordings from, you know, Glenn Miller, Dorsey, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, you name it, and all the great singers of the times. And so I listened to a lot of music, and my aunt, Edith, she loved the vaudeville. So the Apollo Theater was the only theater in Harlem that survived on a weekly basis, bringing in big name bands and singers. I refer to it as the Palace of Harlem. And all the big attractions played there. And my aunt used to take me to the Apollo. And the one outstanding attraction to big bands was Duke Ellington. I was just amazed how he presented his orchestra, not just as band leader, but as composer, arranger, pianist. And the way he began a stage show was just marvelous. That never left me. So that got me going, wanting to get into music. So I studied a little theory. We didn't have a piano at home. So I said, well, I gotta find out about music. Yeah. What are these notes? How do you write? And I began to do that while I was going to grade school, late grade school. But it wasn't until high school, Bob, by second year, I believe it was, I started getting trombone lessons. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning. I had to play something, anything. The only thing that was open, they had some vacancies for trombone instructions. So I took hold of that, and that was the beginning.
Did the school provide you with an instrument at that time?
Yes, they did. Yeah. If you didn't have an instrument, the school would let you, you know, you would borrow it. You could take it home on weekends just to practice. I remember I had a black case with the trombone in it and had number two on it. They all had a record of who had what. Yeah. And I could take it home on weekends and practice. And then when I had learned enough, the bandmaster let me go into the band. Mm-hmm. We played marches. We played at the assemblies. And that was my groundwork, playing in the Commerce High School band.
Right. Was it your aspiration at that time to play with a big band? I mean, did you see yourself maybe someday playing possibly with Duke Ellington?
Well, Yes, I daydreamed about that because I listened to all the big bands on the radio, and of course the Apollo Theater, Uptown, Jimmy Lunsford, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, then the Paramount Theater downtown on Broadway, Benny Goodman, Tommy Dorsey, Glenn Miller, Les Brown, Charlie Barnett.
Yeah.
So your folks, Monsignor, didn't mind you going out and catching the live music. You were allowed to go see the shows.
They were happy that I was interested in it.
Yeah.
My mother and dad loved the movies, and dad loved the sort of the Victor Herbert type, and mother enjoyed the popular music like Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, and they were always singing around the house. And they knew the lyrics, and it kind of grew on to me.
Yeah.
And so while I was in high school, I was enjoying listening to the orchestras, playing in the band, and then 1943, graduation time, I joined the Navy and was very fortunate to get into the United States Navy Band.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing was when you joined the Navy in 43, I mean, after your basic training, the war was still going on. So was there the potential that you may have been shipped off either to the Pacific Theater or the European Theater?
Well, that's a very good question, Jack. I was just finishing my boot training. No matter where you go, everyone has to go through boot training at Great Lakes in Chicago. And I was at a camp where we were just finishing up. And our bandmaster in high school said, gentlemen, he says, you might want to think of joining the Navy. The war is on. You're going to be drafted when you're 18. So he said, but if you, at age 17, you can enlist and pick your service. So he said, I recommend that you think about the Navy band. They can use musicians. So I joined, and near the end of the boot training, the bandmaster came over from the music camp, and he wanted to get some more members so that he can organize bands, send them out all over the country or on ships. So when he said, anyone interested, I raised my hand.
Yeah.
He auditioned me, and he says, I want you to come over with me to Camp Robert Small. And that meant no furlough. But listen, this was an opportunity. And he said, I want you to learn the baritone horn, which was a valve instrument and played in bands. And if you can do that and also play the trombone and the dance orchestra, that would be fine. And I said, yes. So I went with him, began to study the baritone horn.
Were there other well-known musicians in the Navy band at that time who you encountered?
Oh, yes, yeah. Bob. As a matter of fact, there was Willie Smith. Was in the top band of the Navy at that time. They entertained, played shows and everything. They didn't go out any travel far, but they played that whole area, variety shows, whatever they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
Clark Terry was there in one of the major bands in Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
Clark Terry, Gerald Wilson, the great Jimmy Lunsford arranger, he had come into the... So I was amazed hearing Willie Smith, you know, get up and play in his uniform, play something like Blues in the Night that was so popular at that time.
This is the great alto player with Jimmy Lunsford in the 30s and 40s. Later, he played with Duke.
Sure. Yeah. How many times did I hear Willie Smith with Jimmy Lunsford?
Yeah.
And so in October, the band master had put together a band for San Diego, a target repair base, and they needed a band there to do military ceremonies, play the USO shows and dances.
Even funerals, dare I say, things
no,
like that?
We didn't have to play a military funeral, but we played in the middle of San Diego downtown for barn rallies. And so we played band music, you know, Victor Sousa, the marches, and we played all the popular music. We had a library built on the arrangements of the big bands and popular music of that time.
Yeah. So once the war ended, you were able to continue in music?
Yes.
How did you manage to do that? Yeah.
Well, the band was going to be broken up.
Yeah.
Men were discharged, married men first with children, then married men, then single men. So I was one of the last of the band to be discharged.
And were you in San Diego still at this point?
Well, no, Jack. As a matter of fact, in November of 1945, we were sent to San Francisco, to Treasure Island. The band had finished at San Diego. We were just waiting to be discharged. So we're in Treasure Island. Then we were sent to a pre-flight school in Oakland. And little by little, the band was discharging mm-hmm. its members.
So you got to spend, in a very unique way, you got to serve the country, yet still hone your musical skills at the same time.
Yes.
And for my bias, in the beautiful state of California.
Oh, yeah. California was wonderful.
I enjoyed it.
When I came home from the Navy in May 1946, I wanted to go to Juilliard on the GI Bill. Oh, that was a wonderful opportunity. And because we couldn't afford Juilliard at home, but I asked my parents, what do you think? And they said, sure, John, is that what you want to do? But you know, it's a tough field. I said, I know, but I really want to study at Juilliard. So I applied, and I was accepted.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 3 years at Juilliard, and I got a diploma in 1949. Yeah. And I had a great music teacher. His name was David Schumann. He played in the symphony orchestras. He played in the Radio City Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And he guided me to Juilliard. I was nothing to write home about as far as a musician was concerned or a trombone player. But he took me by the hand, and he got me through the studies, and I was able to graduate with a diploma.
So here you are, a musician with a Juilliard diploma, looking to make it in the jazz world of New York City. How did that begin for you?
Well, you start jobbing around. It's mouth-to-mouth thing. It's not looking up in the one ad so
right.
much. But you meet this musician and that musician. You play with this orchestra on a weekend dance, and that leader will remember you and the men you work with, and they'll remember, oh, wait a minute, you need a trombone player? I know somebody. And that's how musicians found their work.
Hmm.
Just, you know, mouth-to-mouth kind of contact. And I began to do that for several years. My big opportunity was when I met Lucky Thompson, one of the great tenor saxophonists.
Yeah.
He was a composer and an arranger. And Lucky wanted to put together an octet. He was thinking about, he played at the Savoy a lot with Lucky Millinder and the other big bands. But he wanted to go in there with his own orchestra. So he started rehearsing an eight-piece octet. Trumpet, trombone, baritone sax, tenor and alto, and rhythm section. And we rehearsed and rehearsed, and Mr. Buchanan, the manager of Savoy Ballroom, heard us, he listened to us, and he said, I'm going to bring you in as a house orchestra.
Hmm.
Let's see how things go. And so we got an opportunity in 1952 to play at the Savoy Ballroom.
So you played there as opposite the big name
the
acts,
big
let's
bands
say,
that
yeah.
came in, Count Basie
uh-huh.
and Erskine Hawkins,
right.
The other big leaders. And we had a wonderful time because when we were not playing for the dancing, we sat in the back there and listened to the orchestra.
Hmm.
And finally, I met Mercer Ellington, Duke's son. I was in between dates at the Savoy Ballroom, and I met Mercer Ellington on a street in Harlem, right near the Apollo Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the musicians, we were just talking. We said, hello, how are you? And Mercer said, well, I got to find Papa trombone player. That's what Mercer did for his dad at times when he needed a replacement, a substitute. Mercer knew everybody in town, and Duke relied on him. Who's free? Who can come out? So Mercer said, yes, as a matter of fact, they're leaving town tomorrow, and Duke needs a trombone. And so a friend of mine said, John, it sounds like there's a job for you. And I looked with amazement, because I would never think of making myself the one who's going to replace. But they encouraged me. And Mert said, yes, John, go backstage and tell Pop that I sent you.
Hmm.
Refer to his beloved dad as Pop. I said, well, all right, I'll go. And they all encouraged me, and I said, my gosh, what am I going to do?
Right.
But I went backstage at the Apollo Theater, and I told the manager I was sent to see Duke Ellington by his son Mercer. So he said, well, go upstairs, knock on the door, Ellington, and I did, and Duke greeted me, and I said, Mercer sent me. So Duke knew what it was about.
Right.
So I'm a trombonist, so he said, who do you play with? I said, well, I play with Lucky Thompson at the Savoy. He said, all right. He said, can you sit in? I said, well, yes. He said, you have your trombone? I said, no, it's in Jamaica. I live in Queens. So he said, can you go get it and come back and sit in on one of the stage shows? I said, all right. So I hurried home and took the subway. Maybe it was the A train or the D train. But it was a downtown express from 125th Street.
I'm sure it was an express.
Yes. And boy, I got to Queens. I just went into the house and I told Mother, I got to go back to the Apollo. Duke wants me to sit in.
Mm. And did she believe you?
Oh, yes. She knew how I felt about Duke.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I got dressed into a nice dark suit, shirt and tie, got the trombone packed up, and went headed back, bus, subway, uptown, and got to the theater. And Juan T. Zoll, who's going to be leaving the orchestra for a little business trip to California,
mm-hmm.
he met me backstage, and he said, come on, let's go. The show was going to start soon. Let me show you. So he took me upstairs to the dressing room and packed the trombone. He said, here, put on my jacket. I was already had a shirt and tie on. And he said, come on, let's go downstage and look at the music. And I went down. Oh, boy, I tell you, we're backstage, semi-dark. The movie is just getting ready to go off. And he's trying to show me the book. Juan sat in the middle of the trombone section.
Right.
And he's showing me the music, and then the lights go out. He said, oh, that's it. We're going to start the show. He said, well, look, don't worry. Listen to the trombone players. They'll get you through. And so next thing I know, the guys are walking on stage with their instruments. Butter comes on to my right. Mm-hmm. Bill Woodman comes in, sits in the first chair on my left.
Yeah.
And we were on a perch, like trumpets are on the other side of the piano in rhythm, and the saxophones are, of course, a front line. And then Duke walks out on the piano. He starts tinkling like he loves to do before he really goes into that first number. And he looks over, and he looks at me, and he smiles. And I tell you, it was a moment of ease.
Wow.
The nerves began to calm down.
Yeah.
I felt he was welcoming me, and I played the show.
So you were at that time a temporary replacement for Juan T. Zoll.
Yes, Bob. Yeah. In fact, before I went home, after the stage show, I said, well, let me go back and see what Duke wants to do. But Harry Carney walked across the stage with his baritone going up, and he looked up and he said, hey, it sounds good up there.
Mm.
Well, that made me feel very good.
Yeah.
And Britt and Butter were just wonderful because they made sure I had the right part, but follow them, don't follow the exact writings, like letter A doesn't always precede B, or B doesn't always, C doesn't follow B.
Right.
You have to be careful, so you have to listen. So anyway, after I left the stage, I went upstage and said, Duke, he said, John, can you come out a few nights? I said, yes, I'm free. He said, okay, the bus will leave tomorrow morning, meet the bus at such a time. And so I went downtown the next day, Piccadilly Hotel, West 40th, the band arrives, we leave, we go to Washington, play a date. After it's over, everyone's packing up, so I start packing up. So nobody said anything. So I followed them, and Duke didn't say anything like, thank you, or what. So I got on the bus. To make a long story short, we went from one nighter to another, 6 weeks across the country to California, one-nighters, and no one said anything.
So you never knew you were hired.
I didn't know. I didn't. I thought just a few nights, yeah. Duke would surely get one of the free trombone players who had played with this one and that one, more experienced. But Juan T. Zoll showed up at Coronado Island. We were playing a Navy engagement, naval officers, and Juan showed up and thanked me, and next thing I know, the guys were saying goodbye. And Jimmy Hamilton, though, said to me, he said, John, maybe one day you'll come back.
Mm.
I thanked him. And next morning, I left on a train back to New York.
Right. And what year was this, Monsignor Sanders?
It was in the spring of 1953.
Okay, so your first date then, spring of 1953, Apollo Theater with Duke.
February.
Sitting
in. And then, like I said, 6 weeks later, we ended up in California. So it was well into April.
And I bet you were scratching your head the whole time.
Well, no one said anything. So I said, well, just go along. And, the manager took care of the weekly salary. And so finally, I got back in New York on cloud nine. I had played with Duke, and I was just happy. And then Duke called me that following February 1954.
Mm-hmm.
He called me and he said, John, can you come back? But this time, can you stay?
And listen, I think that's a great moment, if I may. But mm-hmm. Bob, you had an idea. Go ahead.
Well, we've been talking about Juan T. Zoll. I want to talk a little bit more about Juan T. Zoll in just a short while. But, of course, he was a very important member of the Duke Ellington Band for many decades, really, and on the valve trombone, as well as a very important contributor to the Ellington Book, a composer of number tunes. Why don't we listen to, I guess, what is Juan T. Zoll's best known, or one of his best known pieces, the original version of Caravan, which features the valve trombone of Juan Tizol.
Let's check it out right here on the combined efforts of Just Jazz and Bluesology on WNTI 91.9 FM. I'm Jack Devaney with Bob Bernotis, and here's that original version of Caravan for the Just Jazz Bluesology edition with special guest Monsignor John Sanders.
Great. Juan Tizol featured on the original recording of Duke Ellington's Caravan on valve trombone, also the composer of that piece. And we're here with John Sanders, Monsignor John Sanders, talking about now his experiences with the Duke Ellington band. And speaking of Juan Tizol, well, he actually helped you sort of make a major adjustment musically. You had to switch instruments after a point in the Ellington band. Why don't you tell us all about that?
Well, that's so true, Bob. I went into the Ellington orchestra playing the slide trombone. That was the trombone of the day, the standard trombone. Mm-hmm. And actually, Juan Tizol was the one who really encouraged me to play a valve trombone in the orchestra. When Juan left the orchestra in the 40s to go with Harry James, some other trombones did come in after him. I think it was Wilbur de Paris played and Claude Jones. Mm-hmm. So at least there was two of them I remember coming in, but I don't think they stayed with it long. It wasn't a permanent kind of a replacement.
Right.
And so in 1955, Harry James Orchestra and Duke Ellington Orchestra crossed in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And Juan Tizol, I saw him that night before. They came to our engagement, and Juan said, "Why don't we have a cup of coffee or something tomorrow morning before we both leave town?" I think it was at the Greyhound bus station. So we did. I left my hotel. I got down there, and Juan was there. We had a cup of coffee together, and during that little coffee break, Juan said to me, "John, you know, I think Duke Ellington would like a valve back in the orchestra." Mm-hmm. You know, Tyree Glenn had been playing, but I think he played the slide.
Yeah.
But he was the trombone player who played that middle chair Butter was on third and Britt on first.
Yeah.
I think I have that right. Maybe he was playing third and Butter was playing the middle chair. However, one said, I think Duke would like to have a Val trombone back in the orchestra again. So I said, well, I'd be happy to. He said, you know, John, I have a special instrument I had made by Colicchio, a trumpet maker in Santa Monica. And Juan gave him the specifications for a special valve trombone, a larger bore, a bell, much larger than the standard, a fourth valve playing for lower notes, to lower the range of the trombone.
Right.
And he said, I think it would be good for you in the Ellington Orchestra. I said, well, why not? I'd be happy to. I played a baritone horn, a valve instrument, in the Navy band. He says, I'd be willing to, you know, send you this trombone, and I'll write out the fingering for you, because it didn't finger like a baritone horn, or the pitch was in C.
As opposed to B flat, so.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I had to learn to finger, the trumpet fingering, but with always concert pitch,
right.
And never had to transpose for the valve. And he sent me the trombone. He didn't have a case for it, he had it made, shipped it to New York, and he sent me the fingering. And that summer, we were playing the Aqua Show in Flushing. The Ellington, only a few of the Ellington men could play the show, local 802, and the rest of the orchestra was studio musicians.
Oh, because they belonged to other locals. They couldn't play the Aquacade show.
That's right. Not the whole band. That was an unfortunate occurrence. But then Duke, being featured, would come on at the end and play a medley. And we had the medley arrangement.
And if I may, we're talking like spring, early summer of 54 at this point?
Summer of 55 now.
Okay, summer of 55. You got it.
Yes. So we were playing the Aqua show, and then I spent a lot of time learning that fingering and getting acquainted with this valve trombone. So at the end of the summer, we resumed our engagements. In fact, at the end of that summer engagement, Johnny Hodges came back to the orchestra.
Right.
And a good friend of mine, Ozzie Bailey, who we knew in high school, came as a vocalist.
Yeah.
And I took the instrument out on the road, and I showed it to Britt and Butter, the trombone players in the orchestra at the time, with me, and I said, this is Juan's valve trombone, and he encouraged me to, why don't I try to learn it? And Britt and Butter encouraged me by all means.
Yeah.
And they showed me the parts in the second book, the middle chair, that were tailored for the valve trombone, so I get to know them, you know?
Yeah.
And so one night I went over, I said, Duke, I have a valve trombone here that Juan had made, and he encouraged me to, you know, why not give it a try? And I said, would you mind if I played on some of the numbers? He said, no. So I began to do that. And then one night, Duke asked me to stand up and play a valve trombone solo. It was the Blue Jean Beguine. Cat Anderson had written that, and Juan always played it. And then Butter was always playing it when Juan left the band. So this night, Duke said, John, and, you know, play the solo. So I stood up. I had to read it, you know. I didn't know it by memory.
Yeah.
But when I finished, you know, and then later Duke came to me and said, John, why don't you just play the valve trombone? I said, Duke, I'd be glad to. And Butter and Britt, they guided me right through that middle chair book. Great. And I began to learn the parts.
Now, you mentioned these names, Butter and Britt, and,
yes.
And we're talking, of course, about two of the great trombonists, Britt Woodman, who was a wonderful virtuoso player, could practically play anything, had incredible chops, and Quentin Jackson, who was known as Butter,
yes.
Who was a great plunger player. This is really one of the really fine three-man trombone teams all time in jazz, I would say. Why don't you say a little bit about these two gentlemen, Britt Woodman and the great Butter Jackson?
Well, thank you very much. I first heard Britt at the Apollo Theater, Britt and Butter. Britt had just joined the band because Duke had lost Lawrence Brown and Sonny Greer on drums and Johnny Hodges. So Willie Smith was in the band, and then he left shortly after that before I joined permanently.
Right.
So Britt had come over. He had played with Hampton and from California, and he was highly respected. And he was a gentleman. He really, you know, when you're new in an orchestra, you don't know your way around. It's nice to have someone sitting beside you who is very kind and patient and help you get through the book. The book is big.
Yeah.
So butter and bread. Quentin Jackson kept the plunger style going, the tradition of Tricky Sam Nanton mm-hmm. with the muted trombone and plunger. And Britt was a permanent, kind of a permanent replacement. Some others had tried it, but Quentin Jackson really kind of, I think, if I may say, understood that kind of playing, and he did it so very gracefully. So, and I just admired both of them. Never thought I'd be sitting up there in the middle chair where Juan yeah. was sitting. Just marvelous.
It's 91.9 FM, WNTI. You are in the special edition of Just Jazz with Bob Ronotis and myself, Jack Devaney, including a little bit of this school and class of bluesology. Our special guest here is Monsignor John Sanders. We're talking about his time with Duke Ellington and being a part of the great orchestra. And as Bob has put it, one of the most renowned trombone teams in jazz history. Also, we wanted to share a little bit of music. Bob, what did you bring with us?
Well, we're talking about these two great trombone giants, Britt Woodman and Quentin Butter Jackson. I thought we'd listen to a track that features each one of them with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. This is from Ellington's great album, Such Sweet Thunder, which is a collection of portraits of Shakespearean characters. So we're going to hear first, featuring Britt Woodman on trombone, Sonnet to Hank Sank, which is for Henry V, and then featuring Quentin Butter Jackson on trombone, Sonnet for Sister Kate, which is for Kate, the character in Taming of the Shrew. So here's the great Duke Ellington, first with Britt Woodman, then with Butter Jackson.
Yeah.
89 WNTI, and we just heard, well, two of the great Ellington trombonists of the 1950s, Britt Woodman featured on Sonnet to Hank Sank, Quentin Butter Jackson featured on Sonnet for Sister Kate, and we have the third great trombonist of the 1950s here with us today, John Sanders, speaking about right now his experiences with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. And what did you think about those tracks? You haven't heard them in a while, I guess.
I haven't, and they're just wonderful. Oh, just marvelous. We don't realize sometimes the quality and the outstanding performances of your fellow musicians, you know. We're doing a recording date, and you get the album, you listen to it, and you're happy. But when you go back and listen, you realize it's just so much more wonderful than you ever thought it. It was just, that's the joy of listening to music. Yeah. You never can hear it enough, and you discover new things when you hear it over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I'm just in awe of their ability to bring Duke's music alive. And Duke wrote for them.
Yeah.
He knew exactly what he wanted to hear, and he knew who to assign the musical numbers.
There was a genius of Duke Ellington. He didn't write just generic music. He wrote a piece for Johnny Hodges, for Britt Woodman, for Clark Terry, or Cootie Williams. Yeah.
But the names were on the parts, not first trumpet, or fourth tenor sax, or second trombone. They were personalized. And when you handed out an arrangement, the names were on the parts. The voicings were never in the ordinary manner.
Mm-hmm.
Duke had his own sense of voicing, so you never know who's going to be playing first or second or third.
Actually, that brings up something that I did want to talk about. This might be a good time to raise this. You actually played the role of copyist with Duke Ellington. He would give you, I guess, a score or something, and you would write out the individual parts. How did that process work?
Well, Duke was working very fast. He worked on the road consistently, on the bus, in hotels, wherever he could. He had manuscript with him all the time.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was a stack of manuscript above his seat in the bus. Well, Duke would write, and then when he finished his score, it was done in sort of a compact way. He'd write the saxophones on one stave, trombones on another, and trumpets.
Mm-hmm.
But the copyists, it was all in the concert key.
Right.
So the copyists had to be careful when he copied, except for the trombones, he had to transpose.
Sure.
Five saxophone parts, four trumpet parts. And you had to be careful as you looked at the score, make sure you were consistent and copying each part in the right line, because Duke didn't have time to write it all out fully. In a symphony writing, or maybe writing for a Broadway show, those scores were larger, and the copies just had to go right down from the flute down to the double bass and just copy each sheet. But with Duke, you had to pick out the part and follow it through accurately, transposing. And it was very time-consuming.
Yeah.
At that time, you had ink, paper, and you hope you could concentrate long enough not to make mistakes.
Did Duke notate in things like dynamic markings and articulation and phrasing, or did that come in later during practice, rehearsal?
No, that came in later.
Yeah.
And the men, when we would run over, in fact, we played many arrangements while we're doing a dance date. Duke would say to me, John, if you got anything, meaning did you finish what I gave you, or did you got one chorus, you know? He wanted to hear it right away.
So kind of trying them out.
Yes.
Ah.
So while we were playing a dance, depending on the number, whether it was slow or medium tempo or fast, he would work it into a dance set.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd say, John, pass it out. And the guys would say, uh-oh, here it comes.
Yeah.
A new sheet, fresh manuscript, with just no title on it.
Right.
But just the name. And then Duke, during the dance set, for the next number, if he wanted to hear it, he'd set the tempo at the piano. Duke was marvelous. He was a wonderful pianist. Rhythm section.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't see himself as a soloist. And he would set the tempo, and he'd say, the new one. And he'd work into an introduction, and then he would set up a four-bar intro.
If I may, just as average Joe listening to the stories here, and this is why I had to bring Bob in, it's wonderful, Monsignor. You know, what's fascinating to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you, all this complexity of Duke and far as and the time, the attention, the detail of the arranging, the writing, what would be in his head, what you guys would end up putting on paper, and then what you would have to share for the rest of the band almost on paper. The fascinating thing is we're talking about many times just evening dances here, or just really for the average audience had no clue and no depth as to how complex the music actually was. They're there to have a good time and have an evening out. Correct me if I'm wrong almost, Monsignor.
That's absolutely right, Jack. This was a new piece and they had to sight read. And I didn't have a chance, you know, I had to be careful not to make mistakes, because there's no time for correction.
Yeah.
So you had to be careful. After I finish, I go through again, make sure I got all the lines right on the parts. And the people were just, like you said, they were enjoying themselves. This is another piece in the dance set. And whatever the tempo was, they responded. But the men were sight reading a new arrangement. And what Duke wrote, it stayed. Very seldom did he collect and then change. Mm-hmm. He knew exactly what he wanted. Some nights it was finished, other times I'd give it back, the score back to Duke, and he'd go on and finish the arrangement, and I'd go back to the parts again and finish it.
Yeah.
But you're right, they had no idea what was going on, but the men in the band, they were good sight readers, and they knew how to interpret. But in a recording date, we do the same thing, but Duke had more time to run over things. Let's hear this. And then he would assign the solos. And immediately the guys could respond to what he wanted in this particular arrangement, whether it was Clark Terry or Ray Nance or Johnny or Harry or Jimmy, clarinet, or one of the trombones. They knew how to fit in what he was asking them to do. He gave them that liberty. But he was always musically in control. Yeah. He knew exactly what he wanted.
Now, during the time you were with Duke Ellington in the mid to late 1950s, this was a period in which his band underwent almost like a sort of a renaissance or a rebirth, centering around, of course, that famous appearance at the Newport Jazz Festival in 1956. Of course, you were there. So why don't you tell us about that whole thing? What was it like to be on stage while this incredible musical event was happening?
It was just simply wonderful. It wasn't planned. When we went for that concert that night at Newport, Duke had written a new piece called the Newport Jazz Festival Suite. And we were in New York the day before at NOLA Studios. That's the first time they saw the parts. Yeah. And we were rehearsing and everything. And that was our aim, to bring this new work to the festival. And the first part went sort of routine quite. In fact, it was a little scary there for a moment because some of the men were late. Something went wrong, and not everybody was there when we were about to go on. So Father Norman O'Connor, the MC, had to introduce the orchestra. And Duke, he had great flexibility. He could respond to this emergency, you might say. Not all of them are here. And he knew what to call and how to work our way through that first part. Mm-hmm. But it was a little awkward there for a moment.
Yeah.
And finally, when we took a break, we were all standing around in the back there. And Duke said, when we go back, we're going to do diminuendo and crescendo in blue.
So that was not planned. He just pulled it out at that moment. Uh-huh.
Yes. So,
and for the audience at home, tell us about the tune, you know, just that song in particular, what it's all about.
Well, this is a piece that Duke had recorded, I guess, back in the late 1930s. And it took up two sides of a 78 RPM record. Diminuendo in blue and crescendo in blue were two pieces. And I guess what he did, however, was he pulled these two things out and decided to link them in the middle with that famous tenor saxophone solo.
Well, that's true, Bob. It was played just as an instrumental piece for the orchestra, diminuendo and crescendo.
So was this something that was not always part of the nightly repertoire?
No.
So he kind of put that in the evening. He just said, guys, we're going to do this.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I remember one night, we were down south that same year, earlier that year. We were playing a one-nighter. It must have been June or early July, maybe June. But I remember it was a hot, steamy night in a small ballroom, crowded. And that night, for some reason, we had taken off our jackets. We were playing in our shirt sleeves. And Duke called diminuendo and crescendo. Well, I guess it just sort of caught on. We were relaxed. I hadn't gone to it before, and I said, wow, what an arrangement. And Duke, I think that night, he might have played a 12-bar interlude mm-hmm. to connect diminuendo with crescendo. There was no long tenor saxophone solo, no solos in between.
And it's a very complex arrangement. I mean, each chorus is a very complex, I mean, it's a blues, yes. but it's these incredible variations yes. on the blues that goes through different sections and combinations of instruments. It's a remarkable piece of writing. Yes.
In fact, when I thought of it later on, most recently, I said, you know, that was actually a concerto for orchestra.
Yeah.
The minuendo, yeah. the parts, and each section of the orchestra had a moment to shine.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was an ensemble piece as well. We had to play together. We had to do our section work together. So that he said, we're going to do the diminuendo. So when we went back, I had to go down into the book and get it out.
There were
107 and 108. And so he called it. And he started off with, you know, with diminuendo.
Right.
But he loved to start things with rhythm, just to set the mood. And Sam Woodyard and Jimmy, they were right with him from the beginning.
Jimmy Woody, the bassist.
Yes, yeah. Jimmy Woody, the bassist. And this was going to be an offering because we had done our new work. It was received, I would say, in a courteous way, with yeah. applause. But it was nothing unusual. But we got through. We played that work as Duke had written it. However, so we began to play the diminuendo, and somehow, I think the guys kind of felt something, that we had an awkward beginning, it wasn't the best way things were going, so I think when we went to that old-timer, I think the guys were just relaxed,
mm.
and we played through the diminuendo, I was enjoying it, the parts and everything, and then at the end of it, Duke, the rhythm section, and they played together, and then Duke said, Paul, call Paul's name. Paul knew what that was. Come out, play a solo.
So Paul Gonsalves was not told beforehand he was going to be blowing on that tune.
He didn't know wow. that he was going to play a long solo, 27 choruses.
Yeah.
He thought he'd do a little solo in between diminuendo and crescendo. But Duke in the rhythm section, they were just gelling. Mm. And we could feel that. Joe Jones was down at the foot of the stage. He had done his bit. He was listening to the saxophone in the band. He was having a good time right at the foot of the stage, just as a listener. And he was, you know, edging the guys on. He was enjoying it. And the guys were responding to him.
I understand Joe Jones was hitting the stage with a newspaper, rolled up newspaper. Because he was a drummer, of course.
Yes, he was just, and he was listening and enjoying the rhythm section.
Wow.
And then Duke said, Paul, that meant, come forward, go out to the mic and start playing a solo. And the audience began to react. You could feel it. There was a little rumble and stirring out there, and they were just reacting to this wonderful rhythm. Woodyard, Wood, and Duke Ellington. And Paul was at the mic. One chorus, all right. Two, that wasn't unusual. But Paul was feeling very good and just played. Someone began to dance, and the crowd, you could feel the stirring.
Hmm.
And we never thought it was going to go on for 27 choruses.
Mm-hmm.
And Duke just let things go and played at that piano. He was excellent at that. He was really part of the rhythm section, not Duke Ellington, the soloist. And we could feel that. There was an electricity going through. And finally, when Paul finished, the place was in an uproar. Yeah. They applauded, and we went into the crescendo. And from the beginning to the end, I could feel the excitement in the band and playing the parts. It was all ensemble. No one was standing out, section by section, ensemble. Mm-hmm. And the audience was reacting. They were up on their feet. They were coming closer. And we went through the crescendo. And at the end, we could feel that something special was happening. We weren't just playing it again for the umpteen time. The men were more familiar than I was, but I felt that everyone was kind of feeling the excitement of it, and I was enjoying playing the parts and listening to everyone around me. And when we finished, it was just what a reception of the audience. You felt that they had enjoyed listening. In fact, why don't we go back and listen to some of that? Paul Gonsalves.